The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to Series 7, Episode 5 of Out with Susie Ruffle. Hello. First off, I need to apologise. This episode is coming to you a little bit late this week because, look, it's been a bank holiday weekend and I forgot that it was Sunday. That's the honest truth. We went to my parents for a little Easter break, which was very welcome, and went and had ice creams on the beach. And my mum cooked some lovely food. It was great. But it did mean that I totally lost my bearings. And yesterday, it's Bank Holiday Monday now. Yesterday, my producer Emma got in touch and said, Suze, you haven't sent over the top and tail for this week's episode. The beginning and the end bit. And I said, no, I haven't. Because I thought it was still Saturday, even though it's very much not. And I am not with my recording equipment. So it didn't happen, did it, guys? It didn't happen, but now it is 5 to 8 on Monday morning, Monday the 10th of April, 2023. And I'm late, but I'm here. Better late than never, right? So I'm sorry that this is a little bit late. If you were planning on listening to it first thing in the morning, my apologies. Here it is now. So I've had loads of lovely emails about last week's episode of the podcast with David Atherton. He's lovely, isn't he? We had such a nice chat. Yeah, we just had a lovely time. It was really nice. Thank you so, so much for your lovely emails. He was so honest and thoughtful and compassionate and interesting. If you haven't listened to that one yet, I highly recommend it. He's such a lovely person. Just lovely. Just lovely. And I've had some lovely tour shows. Thank you if you've been to one of them. Oh, I'm having a blast on the road. It's so fun. This week I'm going to Bradford and Leicester. Very much looking forward to those two shows. So maybe if you're coming, I'll see you there. And yeah, we've announced another week at the Soho Theatre if you didn't manage to come, or if you felt that 9:30 in the evening was too late, which, look, I do relate to if I'm being totally honest, but they were still fabulous shows, apart from Friday night where people were far too drunk. But listen, everyone makes mistakes. We live and learn. A couple of people really had a good drink beforehand and then it was all a bit all over the shop. But it was still lots of fun and people were still very nice. And I got loads of messages about it, which was really nice because it suggests that people that come to the show are so lovely that they wanted to make sure I was okay. I was. I've dealt with lots of drunk people before. Unfortunately, it's occasionally part of the job description as a stand-up. But anyway, enough of that. We've released another week of shows at the Soho Theatre. These ones are at the less intoxicated hour of 7:30 in the evening. If you want to get tickets to any of my shows, most of the tour is sold out, but there's a few tickets here and there. You can buy the tickets at susieruffle.com. What about getting in touch, Suze? I'm so pleased you asked. If you want to get in touch, please do. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. Please send me your emails. Please send me your emails to share on the show. I've got two emails to share as per, and then I've got a brilliant episode with Charlie Martin, who is a racing driver who we've been trying to link up for ages, and we finally managed to do it because now we both live in Brighton. So I really enjoyed this chat. It was one of the ones that we did in person, and I'm sure you will too. But before we get to that, let's have a couple of emails. Here we go. Susie, thank you so much for your wonderful chat with David. I was stunned to hear his chat and hear the similarities in our story. I am the son of Pentecostal missionaries and was born and raised in West Africa. I also had malaria a number of times and evacuated Libya at the start of the Civil War in the early 90s. I also went into healthcare. I'm a trained GP after a brief detour into opera. But I'm currently working as a palliative care physician. I also took many years to come out. Lost my virginity at 33, came out to my parents at 34. They had an exorcism on the spot. Wow. I totally agree with David's advice to send a letter. I wish I'd done that because I'll never forget the rage I felt having to stand there and experience my parents not seeing me. And they're assuming that my inseparable part of me is literal evil incarnate. I like to say that it took my 20s to abandon my religion. And when I hit my 30s and started med school, I didn't have the energy anymore to pretend to be somebody I wasn't. Thank you so much for this podcast and for sharing these stories, for letting people hear the queer experience. It is in hearing others' paths that will illuminate your own or develop empathy for those in our circle who may be walking a similar path. I don't think you'll ever know how much good you do when you sit down and have these conversations. Thank you. Virtual hugs from a stranger in Canada. And that's from Kent, who says, if you want to read this, feel free to use my name. Kent, I know who you are. You follow me on Instagram and we often have sort of, I like a lot of your comments because you also listen to like-minded friends. Thank you for this lovely email. Wow, I'm so sorry that you had such a tough time with coming out and with growing up in such a, restricted environment for someone like us. Is that the right words to use? I hope it is. I hope that you're doing okay. I'm so pleased that this podcast has been helpful to you. I'm so pleased that David's episode in particular really resonated. And you're so right. Hearing other people's stories does illuminate the path for yourself. What a great way of putting it. So thank you for that. And thank you for the kind things that you said about the podcast as ever. Yes, I do the interviews, obviously, but it's the people that come on the show that share their stories that are really the people that give up their time to sit and chat and be so honest. But thank you so much for the kind things that you said. I really appreciate it, Kent. And I hope that wherever you are in Canada, you're having a good day today. Right, let's have another one. Let's have a swig of tea first. My voice is very croaky, isn't it? Because it's so early. Here we go. Hi, Susie. I've been writing various drafts of this email to you in my mind since I first started listening to the podcast all the way back when you had Nathan Fode on as a guest, which must be about a year ago. Yes, it must be. It may be even more. Wow. That has been a while. That's a great episode. If you haven't listened to it, that's a great episode. I love him. I started with that episode and then went right back to episode one and have been working my way through in order, but I didn't want to write in until I was up to date, though I'm still not quite there. I'm finally on to the end of series six, just as series seven is starting. I've always been an ally, but I find myself in the odd position of being on the edge of the community and never in it. I'm a probably straight cis woman married to a man, and on paper I feel like I'm promoting a particular model of heteronormativity that doesn't resonate with me. Heteronormativity. Have I said that right? I think so. I say probably straight. The older I get, I'm 36 now, the more I think I'm actually probably somewhere on the ace spectrum. But that doesn't seem like a relevant thing to explore as an identity, as I'm happy and settled in a long-term relationship. So it's not something I have spared much thoughts to. My husband is bisexual, though not really out to many people and not especially interested in being out. I always think that puts me in an odd position when interacting with some of my queer friends. I know what it is to be in a queer relationship, though myself identify as mostly being straight. And because he's not really out, I'm limited to who I talk to about it because only a small number of my friends are aware. This often makes me feel like I'm being fraudulent or overstepping. I feel like I'm in a strange place of being an ally plus, or maybe queer adjacent, but listening to your podcast is really lovely to be able to engage with the LGBTQ plus community and hear people's stories, knowing they're willing to share and that I'm not being voyeuristic by wanting to hear them. I'd love for you to have more bisexual guests, and I know you're always looking to keep representing as much of the community as possible, but I'd be particularly keen to hear from bi people who are in straight relationships. I don't have any actual suggestions, though, I'm afraid. Wishing you and your family well. And that's from Laura. Thank you, Laura, so much for getting in touch. I love the idea of Ally Plus. That's a great way of putting it. And I'm so pleased that this podcast is sort of providing a space for you to feel more connected to the LGBTQ plus community. I have tried to get bisexual people who are in straight relationships or do you still call it a straight relationship, in a relationship with someone of the opposite sex? That might be the best way of putting it. To come on the show, but I've got to be honest, they've all said no. And I think that's, one of them said, I feel worried that I'd get some sort of hate from the queer community, which I reassured her. I said, you really, really won't. But the people that I've asked don't want to share. And, you know, it's the same with people that I've got in touch with that are on the ace spectrum or different types of people. Not everyone wants to put their head above the parapet, I guess. And, you know, in a world where social media can be so angry and people are so determined to tell people what their identity is, I think not everyone wants to do it, but I will keep trying, I promise you, Laura. And hopefully at some point I will have everyone from, I think I have managed to have everyone from the community at some point or another, or a type of person from each part of our community. I do try to. But as I've mentioned before in the show, I'm the only person that does it. I do all the booking, I do all the getting in touch with, and, you know, it's hard to find people, but I will keep trying. I promise you I will keep trying. Mentioning putting your head above the parapet, my goodness, I was on Woman's Hour last week, 2 weeks ago maybe now, and I mentioned that I was in a queer family. I also mentioned that I was a cis woman. My goodness, I shouldn't have done that. Well, I should have. I'm happy to do it. Don't get me wrong. I don't mind people coming at me. But the hate that I got on Twitter, don't call yourself a cis woman on Woman's Hour and then go on Twitter. I mean, as ever, Alice checks my Twitter. I don't really go on there because people are horrible and I'm weak. No, I'm not weak. I just don't want to engage with people that are horrible for fun. But it was so awful, people getting in touch. You're not cis, you're this, you're that. You're an embarrassment to the lesbian community. Okay. Refer to myself as a queer parent. People so angry. You're not queer, you're a lesbian. So angry about what I choose to call myself. What a strange way to live your life. People had saved tweets that I'd put out to sort of, I guess, to come at me. And to give you an idea, I tweet about 5 times a year, 6 times a year. But I guess they have them saved in their phones so that as soon as I say something that they don't agree with, they can send out a tweet saying what a terrible person I am. Usually from a documentary where, once again, I was a trans ally and I got, quite a lot of anger from it. I just find these people absolutely shocking that they would spend their lives waiting for someone so that they can shout at them on the internet. And the mad thing is that I didn't even see it. My wife just went, oh, the TERFs have gone crazy. And it's not hurting me. But what a group of horrible people. And what a reminder that I am pleased that I'm doing this podcast and I'm proud of doing this podcast. And let's share today's episode. It's with the brilliant Charlie Martin. I really hope you enjoy it. We had a lovely chat. I really enjoyed this conversation with her, and I hope you do too.
Oh, hello, listener. I am very excited for today's conversation. Charlie Martin is a British racing car driver and a transgender activist who uses her status as a prominent racing driver to raise awareness of LGBT rights. In 2022, she got the silver medal at the North American Lamborghini Cup. Pretty bloody impressive, I'd say. She has a third place finish at Le Mans for the Bugatti circuit. She's also an ambassador for Stonewall and led a world first, a campaign with the Ginetta GT5 Challenge at Silverstone for drivers to have rainbow stickers on their cars to show support for equality and diversity in the industry. We've been trying to set up this interview for bloody ages, so I'm delighted to have her here today. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, Susie. Thank you for persevering with this as well, because honestly, it's super cool to be here today.
Oh, that's so nice of you. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, I'm feeling slightly spaced. I moved home last week and I've had a massive boxing session in the gym this morning.
So. Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Good for you.
I'm feeling good. I'm just feeling a little bit like I'm having a sugar low. But if I start talking gibberish, just throw a glass of water in my face.
Do you have to do, I mean, obviously you have to stay really fit being a racing driver, but do you have like certain like PTs you have to keep up with every week to like keep yourself strong enough?
I mean, you know, you do have to be really fit. It kind of depends what level and what discipline you race in.
Right.
But I mean, personally, I'm a very sporty kind of active mm-hmm. person anyway.
Yeah.
I enjoy exercising, which is quite handy. But yeah, there's certainly a lot that you can do to, you know, to improve your performance. I guess like any sport, you know, any athletes, you get to a point where you've made all the big gains. You've done, you know, so many hours of what you do.
Yeah.
And you're always looking for those little incremental gains.
Yes.
Those things that add up to suddenly like 5-10%. And I think within working with not only your physical agility and strength, but also your mental agility.
Yeah.
There are some really big gains there, I think. And like when you're driving for a long time.
Yeah, so we were just talking about like the 24 hours in Le Mans.
Yeah.
So look at me learning the things. And that's three drivers over 24 hours.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So how long would you do at a time?
You would typically do... So a stint is based on how much fuel you've got.
Oh.
So it could be an hour and a half, or you could do a double stint, or you could potentially do a triple stint. So that's, I mean, that's like you drive into the pits, car goes up on jacks, just like that.
Just like that.
Good sound effects.
Thank you. I do all my own sound effects.
They change the tyres, fill it up with fuel. So you get, you know, 60 seconds, 90 seconds of like, you know, have a little drink, just,
and then off you go,
zone out for a minute, off you go again. And so,
and
you
how
think,
fast would you be driving you on a course could, like that?
You could hit up to, depending what car you're driving, 170,
oh my
nearly
God.
200 or 200 miles an hour actually for the fastest cars. And at that kind of speed, you have to, you can't lose focus for
no,
a moment.
No, I was just about to say, like, doesn't the focus sort of like, this might sound mad, but doesn't it like hurt your face? Like, you, do you know what I mean? Like your eyes, where you're like focusing, or is that a learning thing of like you have to actually relax?
I mean, that's one of the skills that you have to develop is being able to relax when you're, because our heart rate will be up anywhere between 150 to 180 beats per minute.
Mm-hmm.
So you think that's like running full power on a treadmill.
Yeah.
And your heart rate's doing that for an hour and a half. Then with a tiny break, and then again and again. And so it's like, you know, trying to be a bit zen and trying to be able to kind of, obviously you're really hyped up, but also, yeah, just be calm enough that you're kind of present of your surroundings and you don't kind of burn yourself out, because otherwise, you know, you get out of the car and you're just completely frazzled.
Yeah, totally.
And
it's part of the training about the mental agility. Because, like, surely staying focused for that long, like, you've got to really be, like, you can't, like, when you're doing 200 miles an hour, you couldn't be like, I wonder what I'll have for tea tomorrow. You literally can't go into autopilot.
But that's, I mean, honestly, the funny thing is, that's exactly what can happen. You know, you just have some random thought pops in your head. And I don't know if you've ever done meditation, but it's the same thing where, you know, thoughts come and go and you just have to let them go.
Mm.
But it's inevitable, really.
That yeah, when you can't.
You're driving for that long, it's going to happen at times. Something catches your attention, whatever it is, something in the rearview mirror, something happening up ahead.
Yeah.
You know, like the sun's coming up and you think, oh, that's really pretty.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, crikey, there's a corner. And so...
Do you get nervous before you get in?
I do, yeah. I think if you don't, then, I mean, maybe the top elite level drivers like Formula One and stuff,
yeah,
because they're just on such a level. But I mean, personally, I think everybody gets a bit nervous, right? Everybody gets butterflies in the morning. Personally, I find the worst bit is when, I don't know, an hour or two before I get in the car, and I'm just kind of, you know, bouncing around the garage, sort of
what
feeling
does your
a little
day look like? Sorry, I interrupted you then, which is very rude.
No, not at all. It's like typically you're up at about, I don't know, 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
I try and get some breakfast in quite early, maybe do a bit of meditation, have a shower, whatever, get to the track.
Get your cool suit on.
I love your cool suit.
I've seen so many videos of you in your cool suit.
Were they saying that? It depends, because I mean, if it's really, really hot, I'll probably stay in shorts and a t-shirt as long as I can.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, maybe run through things with the engineers, you know, a bit of strategy, the weather might have changed, it might have, you know, oh, we've changed the setup, all these kinds of things. Maybe look back through some of your onboard. So all those kind of like techie sort of things to prepare and just refresh what your game plan is for the race. I do, a lot of drivers do some kind of mental, physical warm-up. So I've got one of these. I don't know if you've seen it. It's like a boxing trainer. It's a rubber band.
Yeah.
Goes around your head with a boxing ball on a bit of elastic. Yeah. And you punch it and it kind of springs back at you. So it just gets your hand-eye coordination going.
I can imagine that's quite meditative. Like just getting it at the right like rhythm.
Yeah, exactly. And it just gets your brain, your eyes, your arms, your hands all kind of working together. Just kind of wakes you up, really. And then it's really just that bit before you get in the car where I'll put my headphones on. And that's,
what will you listen to?
Oh, I've got a few playlists. A lot of kind of like electro and like synth wave and stuff. I quite like that kind of thing. Something quite atmospheric, you know, that gets me sort of in the zone a bit.
Yeah. And I've got a playlist for before stand-up.
Do you?
Yeah. So it's just always quite interesting hearing other people's...
What kind of things do you listen to?
I've got one playlist that I made called Big Gay Party, which is like I'm Coming Out, Elton John, Janelle Monáe, Christine and the Queens, like really sort of pop and then some sort of slightly cooler stuff, but like sort of queer anthems.
Nice.
Yeah, like I Am What I Am, but the disco version. Yeah, loads of really sort of big sort of camp classics.
And things that just like give you that feel good, kind
things
of build
that
you
I
up.
Like to, if I'm like, I'll often like have a bit of a walk before the gig and like the thing that will be like, bam, bam, like it might be like, so Paul Simon's one of them. Dun, 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 dun.
Nice.
Dun, 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 dun. It's like good to walk to.
Yeah.
But they're all like really, they're songs that I want to dance to basically. And so I'm like, I need to do something. So I'll go and get on stage.
And I guess just like give you that energy that you need.
Yeah,
to...
it makes me feel positive. I couldn't listen to like Adele or something who I love. Yeah. But like, I'd be like, oh, fuck this. Yeah. I'll go and sit down and have a glass of wine in front of a fire.
Yeah. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah, sorry, the show's off. I'm all of a sudden really sad.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
So were you always into cars? Were you always into, like, from a kid?
I wanted to be a fighter pilot. That was my obsession, I think. It's probably not too strong a word. Top Gun.
Right? Yeah, so right. Okay.
I would have been, I think it was 1985. So I'd have been about, 4 or 5 years old.
Okay.
And all I wanted to do was fly planes. You know, I totally geeked out on it.
Whereabouts did you grow up?
In the Midlands, in Leicestershire.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So I up until the age of about 10 or 11, that was just 100% all I could think about, you know. So
that's adorable.
I used to build model planes and read books about planes and
just everything. Have you got a pilot's license?
No, I've done a bit of flying.
Right.
Which I really enjoyed, and I'd love to get my PPL, but then motorsport's just such an expensive hobby.
Yeah, I bet.
And try and do both.
Yeah, impossible.
Yeah, maybe one day, you know.
Sure.
But for now, I'm just stick to racing. But the long and short of it was I'm terrible at maths and physics. Like, that's just the complete opposite of how my brain is wired up. And I remember my mum having a conversation with me in the nicest possible way, but basically being a bit like, look, because you had to get really good grades. I think you need A-level maths and physics.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know if it's still the case.
Right, but then certainly, yeah.
You know, you've got to be able to do like 533.6 times 10,012 in a upside down pulling 6G And
yeah, I would have trouble with that.
Yeah,
I mean, even without the upside down and the 6G and without a calculator, I'd still like, it's just, yeah, that's tough. So did you, at what point were you like, oh, well, then maybe racing?
Yeah, around that kind of similar time, mm-hmm. actually. One of my friends at school, his dad used to race.
Oh, cool.
And I remember going away with him, going to stay with him for the weekend once, and he's like, oh, yeah, you know, like my dad, I knew his dad raced, and he was like, yeah, you know, we'll go race with my dad, you know, or like camp and stuff. And I was like, oh, cool, cool, you know. I was always into the idea of, yeah, adventures, yeah. and things that are different. And I just really loved it, you know, being in the paddock and actually involved in what was happening and trying to help out and I don't know, just like the noise and the, even like the smell of it, yeah, it's just
burning rubber.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, cool. And then whenever there was an opportunity to go and do that, I did. And also things like consoles taking off at that point in time.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
So I grew up playing Gran Turismo and Colin McRae Rally and all these kinds of games, and I was like, wow, racing's cool. So I kind of pivoted into motorsport.
And then is that what you did after, like, did you do that after school? Like, how does that even become your job?
I had no idea how. And for a long time I thought motorsport is something else, something that other people do.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I looked at it. Then my friend started racing with his dad when he was 19.
Mm-hmm.
And I was suddenly like, oh, okay, maybe this is something I can do, because, you know, my friend Hamish is doing it, and yeah, why not? But I mean, I didn't know which way you turn a screw to tighten it or undo it. That's how little kind of mechanical knowledge I had.
Okay.
And I thought, yeah, if you get into racing, you've got to be able to like do all this kind of stuff and strip an engine. But I ended up buying this car through my friend's dad. Year I left university. I mean, completely logical, really, in terms of like having no money as just like an ex-student.
Yeah.
But I made up my mind, this is, you know, I'm going to go for it. And I had this vision and this determination that, yeah, you know, I'll just learn on the job. And I saved up 1500 quid, bought this little Peugeot, and had to spend a year kind of like putting it together, because it was just like a box of bits.
Now, is that like those cars that you sometimes see people like on like the motorway, where you can see like those old Peugeot? Is that what you mean?
It was a 205, so it was like,
okay, yeah, I remember the 205.
Right, yeah. Yeah, like, I mean, classic hot hatch. I wish I'd still got it, because I mean, they're super collectible now.
Right, okay.
Like, so it's, I don't know, like 1989, yeah. 1992 kind of car, that kind of age.
Yeah.
And yeah, I took me a year to you know, I had to get a few people on board at times, but a lot of the stuff I did myself. Like, we had a spray booth at my family business, and I got someone to show me how to spray, and I sprayed it and things like that.
I would find that so satisfying.
Oh,
like, so doing something from scratch is so good for the soul, right?
It is. Yeah. And to see it move along.
Yeah.
And like, as you say, you feel so invested in it emotionally that I'll never... Yeah, I don't think I'll ever kind of forget what that meant to me at that point in time. I was like, well, even if I'm really crap, like, I've got here, you know.
Yeah.
I've bought this car, I've made it,
I've done it.
I'm here,
yeah.
You know. I'm doing motorsport. So, really humble beginnings, you know. Started off at club level. I used to camp in a tent. I mean, I used to spend like £1,000 a year. That was like my budget.
Yeah,
which is
while you were working and yeah,
exactly. I never had any like real feeling like, oh yeah, this is going to be, this starts here and it goes to here.
Right.
It was just like, cool, this is me, I'm doing my thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, big achievement.
Yeah, definitely. And so I read in an interview with you that you said that there was a point when you thought, well, I'm sort of misquoting you, so please forgive that, but you said something like, I didn't think that I could be a transgender person and also in motorsports. It was like those two things.
Yeah, 100%.
It was impossible.
Yeah, these things are diametrically opposed.
Right.
It's never going to happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so at what point did you know, when you were growing up, were you aware of sort of, I often describe my experience is like an otherness. Like I knew I was other. I just knew that I didn't, that I wasn't like the other girls, basically.
Yeah.
And wasn't like the other boys either. I just knew that I didn't quite fit. So did you have that growing up? Were you aware of the sort of dysphoria as a child?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, very, like a very similar feeling, if I'm honest. When I was, I guess, six, maybe seven. Really hard to put my finger on exactly what that was or how I knew that. I remember there was a thing when I was at Alton Towers with my family and I had this like amazing bowl cut in the 1980s. I think I was probably wearing dungarees. Maybe looked a little bit, you know, androgynous.
Yeah.
Some other parents said to my dad, oh yeah, but your little girl's going on the ride with you. I bet she's really excited. And my dad was like, that's my son. It's not my daughter. And this story just used to get like, you know, repeated sometimes in whatever context. Like it was a funny thing. And I guess I remember whenever I heard that thinking that, I wish I was a girl and I felt that I was a girl. And that's maybe the earliest thing where I couldn't really put my finger on why, but I was like, there's something here that's not quite right. You know, it doesn't sit with me in the right way.
And I think for so much longer, you know, as a gay woman, we've had the language for so much, or at least the language wasn't necessarily pleasant, there was sort of an understanding of what being gay was or what being a lesbian was. Like we're a similar age, there's a few years between us, but you know, I feel like I wouldn't have even known that transgender was a thing really,
right,
as a young person. So if you're feeling that yourself, I can't imagine, like it must be quite isolating.
Yeah, I think so, because there was such a long period of time in my whole childhood and adolescence, even showing my age here, until the internet was invented.
Yeah.
And up until that happened, the only times I saw trans people were, you know, more like either drag queens in films, or this is someone who's a transvestite.
Yes.
Which is, you know, which was really painted in a very kind of weird, negative, outsider kind of, you know, this is a wrong kind of thing.
Yeah,
these
definitely.
People who do this thing that, you know,
sort of sexually deviant almost.
Right.
So there would be, there would be elements of how people that were, that didn't fit into that sort of binary box would be painted.
Yeah, like it's something you should, like, be ashamed of.
Yes.
This is who you are.
Yeah.
And then, you know, occasionally someone who's transsexual, as it was termed back in the day, you know, which again kind of sexualizes the whole idea of being trans in the first place.
Yeah.
And
yeah, and I've never really thought of that. But yeah, of course, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
It makes it, about sex, which isn't gender.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas transgender is just much more like, oh, okay, it kind of explains what it is.
Yeah, it does what it says on the tin.
Does what it says on the tin, exactly.
So, I can understand this. This makes sense.
Yeah. Without any of the kind of other stuff, you're just like, well, you know, crikey. Like, I mean, I grew up feeling just really, like alone, that I couldn't talk about how I felt and, you know, trying to understand yourself in the whole context of what that is. And yeah, just feeling like there's something really wrong with me. Which is kind of fucked up, really.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I'm trying to like desperately drag a positive from somewhere, but like the invention of the internet just means that young people today have such a wealth of information. I mean, there's also problems with the internet, but also like that's why it's so brilliant that you've been such an ambassador to show people that you can do. Sort of, you can be several things, and that things aren't, you know, if you are one thing, it doesn't mean that you can't be another thing. And so you were already racing, you were already in that world, you already sort of had your industry. Did you just get to a point when you thought, I can't pretend to be this person anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I outwardly, I was quite heteronormative.
Right.
I think growing up, you know, there's times when I tried to be a bit more expressive about my gender identity and a bit androgynous and things, but probably fairly unsuccessfully, I think, in terms of trying to really get answers that I needed to find about myself.
Yeah.
And just reach some level of kind of self-acceptance, basically.
Yeah.
And it's funny because of what you just said, because the thing that really changed it for me was, I guess a couple of things. Primarily YouTube and seeing people my own age who are transitioning.
Right.
I mean, like, whoa. It was like someone telling me the earth isn't flat.
Right, okay.
Because I got one idea of one really horrible, I say horrible, but yeah, one very distorted idea of what being a trans person might potentially mean for me in terms of living the rest of my life. And then suddenly, like, oh, here's loads of people my own age, and you know, they've all had their kind of trials and tribulations, but most of them are just really happy and they're living their life. And, you know, they've got friends and they've got jobs and, you know, they're not complete social outcasts. In fact, actually, they look really like they're living their best life.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa, okay. Maybe I can live that life.
Was that quite a frightening thing to realise that it was possible? Because then it's like, oh, well, then I have to do it all.
A little bit, yeah.
Tell everyone and work out what this version of me where I'm being more authentic is.
Yeah, it's a little bit like opening in a positive way, opening Pandora's box,
because
you're
right?
just like, once you've learned all these things, you can't put them back in the box. You're like, wow, now I know all this stuff. And then another part of that was my transsexual summer, which was, I think, 2011.
Yes, I remember watching that.
And that was a really groundbreaking show.
Now, remind me, was it, they all lived together in a
they
house?
They did, yeah. And then they go away and come back.
And they're all transitioning.
Yeah, that's it.
But they're all different ages, right? They're like, there was younger people. Yeah, I remember watching that.
Yeah, and I think it was a really important show as well on a lot of levels, but also because it showed a lot of trans men, which, you know, previously I think the focus had just been on trans women.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm good friends with two of the people off that, Fox Fisher and Lewis Hancock. And that's been, again, meeting them. They were some of the first trans people that I met, and through YouTube and vlogging and stuff. And so, although that was actually, I met them actually, you know, some way into my transition. But first off, it was, YouTube and I just, I think I just realised there's a whole part of me which I've never really understood, and I'm going to go through my whole life and I'm never going to know who I am. And, you know, sorry to be a bit dark about it, but, like, you know, one day I'm going to die and I'm never going to have lived a day as me in my whole life. And that's a pretty profound thing to suddenly be faced with. And so I knew on one hand that I had to transition, but then on the other hand, I was like, I'm kind of paralyzed by the fear of what this is going to mean in my life, in my career, in motorsport, you know, and all these kinds of things. But it reached a point for me where things got really, really bad from a psychological point of view, and I hit rock bottom. And when you hit rock bottom, there's only one place you can go, and that's upwards.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, this is going to be hard. It's going to be scary, but it's also exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the only way to do it. So, yeah, January 2012 was when I took that kind of step into the unknown.
And did you begin by sort of telling people? And is that something? Also, we don't have to talk about this if you don't want to.
No, it's cool.
Yeah, how did you begin that process?
So it was a case of first, you know, starting with closest people in my life.
Yeah,
so my family. I mean, both my parents passed away a long time ago, so I've got two older brothers,
right,
who I worked with at the time. So I told them, and then started with friends and people, and gradually you kind of work your way out.
Yes.
And I suppose also you get to a point where you've told enough people that you know, especially living in rural Leicestershire at the time, kind of news travels fast.
Yeah,
and
I
people
bet.
Like to gossip.
Yeah.
So you get to a point where you're like, okay, everybody kind of knows now. So like, you know.
But was there an element of like relief with that?
Massive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like, on the one hand, you don't want to be gossip, but on the other hand, if everyone knows, then it's done.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Okay, fine. Like, yes, this is the thing. This is it. This
right.
is me.
And I remember the first few people I told, and I was like, I was so worked up about it. And I, you know.
And was the language even, like, obviously we'd had that show, My Transsexual
Summer.
Transsexual
yeah.
Summer. Yeah, sorry, I want to get the name right. And, but were people, because I feel like now if I said to, for example, my mum, or like someone not of our generation, a bit older, if you said trans, they'd be like, yeah, okay, I get this.
Uh-huh.
But like 10, 11 years ago, was that language even?
Yeah, I think it was still, certainly there were people I spoke to that I had to, you know, I had to articulate things in quite simplistic terms.
Yeah.
And but then the funny thing was, and I'm sure this probably resonates with a lot of people in terms of their own coming out stories, that, you know, initially I was so worked up and trying to, you know, I'm going to do it here and I need to, you know, it was like planning the moon landings, you know. and I'd be like, you know, there's this thing I've got to tell you and it's really, it's been terrible my whole life and, you know, da 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 da. And I'd tell them and then they'd be like, okay, all right, well, hey, you know, something, you know, really supportive. Yeah, you're my friend. Wow, that's really brave, you know. And by the third person, you're like, it was much easier. And by like the 10th person, you're like, well, basically I'm trans and I'm going to transition, you know.
Yeah.
It just becomes a lot easier, really. And I think that having people accept you is just a wonderful thing, right?
Oh, massively.
You just suddenly feel like, oh gosh, what have I worried about all this time? You know, it's like, why didn't I tell people a long time ago? So, yeah.
When you were beginning your transition, did you take a break from sport? Were you...
I took probably a year off. Yeah, it would have been a whole year off from racing.
Mm.
I gave up, basically, because I thought no one's going to accept me. I actually thought that's the end of that.
So you did feel like you had to choose a lane, and in the end you chose you rather than sports.
Yeah. And I'd never seen any LGBTQ+ visibility in that space.
No.
And it's that old cliche of if you can't, you can't be what you can't see.
100%.
So I told a couple of friends, two really close friends, one of them never spoke to me again. And I think that in itself is like, you know, you need a bit of encouragement at that point in time. And I thought, well, yeah, that's quite 50-50 sort of response. Made me feel like, no, it's just not going to work. And I actually, my friends and my family who said, look, you know, don't you at least just want to go back, see everyone, and just at least then you know.
And at that point, were you, I'm reminded of a conversation I had with Isla Holden, who, do you know Isla?
Yeah, I know Isla quite well.
Yeah, because she, when she came on the show, she said that there was like a point where she went home one weekend with the male uniform and walked in on the Monday in the female uniform. And I said, I think that's probably one of the bravest things I've ever heard anyone do.
Yeah.
But were you, did you feel like you were taking like a new version of yourself? Like, were you holding yourself in a different way? Were you wearing, like, were you, like, did you think about what you were going to wear? Like, it just feels like it would be massive.
Yeah, it's true. There are so many things that were going through my head at that point in time. And it's really, I think it's so hard when you've lived your life. So I was 30. Right, so I lived like pretty much, you know, a big chunk of my life without ever, you know, expressing this side of me really, or certainly not in public, you know,
with
people in an environment that I would never choose to walk into at this very, very early stage when everything feels super, you know, raw. So yeah, in terms of how you hold yourself, how you're trying to speak and dress and all these things, it's like a It's like spinning plays.
Yeah.
A little bit.
And how was that response then when you went into the pit and you saw your friends?
Yeah, it was pretty terrifying. If I'm honest, it's one of the scariest things I've ever done. And I remember just sitting in my car thinking in the car park, like, I could just drive home now and it would be so easy. But something in me was like, come on, you're here.
You got this far.
Yeah, like, at least you'll know in about an hour. You'll have some kind of an answer. And I mean, I've said it a lot of times, you know, the small group of my friends, my closest friends that I raced with, nine people maybe, that really made an effort to welcome me back into that space, really helped me get through that experience. And because the majority of people just looked at me like I'd landed from another planet, not in a nasty way, like they were like, oh, you know, get out, we don't want you here. It was more just like, what on earth is this trans person doing here? Because you just, you know, none of them had ever really probably knowingly met a trans person.
Yeah.
And in that space, it was just, I think it just felt, yeah, very alien for me to, and I think some people probably didn't even know, maybe didn't even recognise it was me, or,
right,
you know, just like, what the hell's going on with Charlie? You know, or it was just really, really uncomfortable. So yeah, the people that kind of came over and were like, hey, how you doing? Give me a big hug. And, oh, you're going to come back racing next spring. We really want to get you back. You know, we really missed you this summer. And you're like, oh.
That must have been amazing.
Yeah, it really was. It was a really, really profound thing.
And I might be totally wrong here, but I sort of imagine that space to be sort of quite testosterone fueled. Like, how many women are in that?
Not a lot. In terms of drivers, you know, engineers, mechanics and so on, you know, very much, women are very much in a minority.
Yeah.
So I think now, 10 years on or so, we're seeing, you know, more women come into that space in all kinds of roles within the motorsport industry. And there's been some really effective initiatives to try and encourage more women and younger girls to, you know, into careers, because of course it's not just driving.
No, of course.
But that takes time to have effect.
And of course.
So even today it's still very, you know, it's changing, but it's changing slowly.
Does everyone just drive together? It's not there's not female races and men. Like, I know that when you're in your teams, but is there anything differently about how you sort of were on the track?
I mean, initially I'd say no, but I, over the sort of first two years of transition, I went from being like a pretty average driver in terms of results and things like that to suddenly getting to a point where just basically getting better. And I think a big part of that is just down to confidence, down to self-belief. It's like, you know, getting in a car and driving really quickly involves, on the one side, it's like skill and all that kind of thing, but also you can't take out the fact that you've got to be brave and you've got to push yourself. And I guess really on a simplistic level, if you feel more confident in yourself, and on a really like subconscious level, you know, if you don't even really believe in the person that you are, like the person me here sat today isn't actually me. And I doubt myself on so many levels because of, you know, fundamentally, I'm not even in the right skin. That's going to affect so many things that you do, right?
Your choices,
your decisions, you make in a split second. And a lot of that filters through into when you then drive a car and race a car. And there's no way I could have got to the point I'm at in my career as a driver now had I not transitioned. Like, I just couldn't perform on the same level. I just don't think I would ever have got close to unlocking your potential as a human being, right? You know, we talk about the benefits of living authentically. Mm-hmm. And I think the experience I've gone through has made that so, just so relevant to me in terms of like what I've managed to do as a driver, really. Mm. You know, it's really opened my eyes.
And I guess unlocking potential in, like, you know, I'm someone that's like, I'm very defined by like my job and I'm kind of obsessed with my work. But there's something about like when you're living, like you realise, like the more that you live authentically, I think, the more you realise like, oh yeah, that's just like my job. And I love it. And I love my job.
Yeah.
But that sort of opens up the sort of possibilities of what your life can look like.
Yeah.
Did you find that like just all aspects of your life was like, oh.
Yeah.
Like, was it like...
Yeah, you review everything.
Yeah.
Because I grew up feeling limited, right? This is who I am in life. This is my lot. And, you know, I can't really be the person I want to be. And therefore that, you know, well, I have to choose between a career that I perhaps want to go for, but I can't be me. Or if I do want to be me, I have to choose, you know, a life of being an outsider, and so on and so on. So, that informs everything, you know, the what you hope to maybe earn, the lifestyle choices that you therefore will be able to make in life, you know, how many holidays you have a year, all these little things, you know, that knock on from that.
Totally.
And so it's like... opening up all those kind of possibilities of like, actually, yeah, on the one hand, I can be my best self, I can be happy, and then on the other hand, that's going to then enable me to be a happier person, to be better at what I do, and just to make the right choices that are the things that I want.
Yeah, something that I've learned is something that, like, I think I've spoken about a lot with other guests on the podcast before, is that I think quite often, and I think it's certainly now, I mean, we're in quite a frightening time, certainly for transgender people, and I think for the whole queer community, like, it's a strange time, I think. And so much of, like, the rhetoric that I certainly consumed as a young person was, like, if you're queer, if you're gay, if you're other, like, you will be sad. Like, your life will be sad.
Yeah.
Like, you won't have a partner.
Yeah.
And if you do, it will sort of be tragic. Mm. And if you do have a partner, like, you know, there'll be some sort of story where, like, lesbians always die, or, like, she'll leave you and then you'll have this very sad life. And I think for, like, lots of guys that are friends and also people that I've interviewed have said, like, you know, it was AIDS. You're going to get AIDS. So, like, watch it. You know, it was so much of what we consumed as young people. And I think it is changing now. Like, there's loads of really positive stuff, like Heartstopper and, you know, positive queer stuff that we can all consume. But I don't know, for me, it felt like, well, you can't be happy and gay.
Yeah. It's just, it's a fairy tale. It's not going to happen in reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think I had a dream, a kind of fantasy of what my life might potentially look like if I lived in a parallel dimension. And that's how disconnected it felt from reality, because I just couldn't really fathom how events and things might come together to result in, say, the life that I live now. It just didn't feel, it just didn't feel possible.
But that's like, as you were talking about, you know, the fact that there hadn't been a transgender person walking into, like, a pit, you know, in an area where all the drivers would be before, the fact that you've done that means, like, no one in the world will ever have to say that again.
Yeah.
Like, that's so hopeful. And, like, as you know, like, we've been aware of each other for quite a long time. I've been trying to get this in, and, like, I follow what you're up to on social media and stuff like that. And, like, the thing that I was going through your social media this week and, like, just looking at different things that you've done. And, like, your social media just screams happy. Like, it's such a, like, it'd be such a hopeful thing for someone to look at and be like, oh, it's possible. Like, you've got a great career. You're in love with your partner. You've just bought a house. Like, it's so hopeful.
I mean, that's really kind to, I mean, you know, I guess I, you know, it makes me feel happy that things come across in that way, because I guess I'm, you know, I've always felt that despite everything, I've been a very positive person. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I've been wired up since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I'm very much like glass half full kind of person. And I guess that's probably something that's carried me a long way through the, you know, the difficulties that I've had in life. A lot of which were to do with being trans, but some of which, you know, were just other things. You know, we all have bad things that happen, right? Mm-hmm. But I've always wanted to try and paint a realistic picture of being trans, but also, and I think it, of course, it is really important that there are activists and people out there as well who are, you know, talking about a lot of the negative things yeah. that are happening. And I do try to do my bit to, you know, to shine a light on things that people who follow me who aren't from the community perhaps would have no idea about, perhaps. Yeah. And, you know, one of those is, you know, the way that trans women are treated in sport, for mm-hmm. example, and try and educate people around the realities. But nonetheless, I try to just be, you know, positive, really, because I think one thing I've learned is that back at the beginning, when I was transitioning in motorsport, it was really tough because people just didn't understand what being trans meant mm-hmm. and what I was going through and why I was doing what I was doing. And I think most people just couldn't relate. And I think from those first 2 years, as people started to see me come out of my shell and see me become more confident and believe in myself, and how, I guess, just how your kind of aura sort of transforms going through that process, people could see I was really happy. Mm. And it's a bit like a virtuous circle, you know, and I guess no one who knew me through that process could kind of turn around and go, oh yeah, I don't get it. It was like, oh, obviously you're just really happy to be you. And how can anyone deny someone that experience in life, mm. right? You're not hurting anyone. So I just think that actually showing all the good aspects of your life and sharing that on social media is really just, I don't know, it's a good way of like getting people to feel more empathy, right? Yeah. Getting people to connect with something that's really tangible, that's like, you know, okay, you're always going to get idiots and trolls and people like that. Yeah. But like, anyone else would look at that and just be like, yeah, I'm happy for you.
Yeah.
Like, you're having a great life. And that's something that hopefully then they take away, and they're going to, anytime they meet a trans person or they're going to read something, they're going to be like, actually, no, you know, trans people aren't trying to, I don't know, do any one of the ridiculous things that some horrible tabloid might try and put in people's heads. Trans people are just trying to live their best lives and be happy.
Yeah.
Right. And that's as simple as that. And why wouldn't you support that? And that was a probably very convoluted way of
But I think that's, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what you're doing. You're achieving that.
Thank you.
You're achieving that. So I always ask people the same question who come on the show. It's sort of a, you know, if you could reach out to a version of yourself before, or if you want to think about yourself, maybe think about someone that's maybe in a similar position. And I may be thinking of the version of you that was in that car, thinking outside, you know, where all your old pals from motorsports were inside, people that you used to work with, and you were making the decision to go in as the real you, and you thought, I could just drive away now. If you could reach out to her or someone in a similar position right this moment, what would you say?
I'd say things are always a lot worse in your head than mm-hmm. they are in reality. Mm-hmm. I think we all have a tendency to overthink and, turn our problems into mountains that we just, you know, we're afraid of climbing. I'd say one thing I've learned is that, and it didn't happen overnight for sure, but you have to push yourself sometimes in situations like that. But it's taught me subsequently to never question my right to feel valid in any space. And I guess that's how I felt back then. I didn't feel valid in that space. I didn't mm-hmm. feel welcome. But actually, again, it kind of comes back to the first thing of just, you know, feeling that fear within us that I think people generally are, you know, good and kind in mm-hmm. their hearts, and we all want other people to feel happy and to feel loved. And actually, sometimes there's a bit of a bridge to build, but actually, once you build that bridge, people will support you, people will be on board, people will become, you know, some of your greatest allies mm. might be the people you never expected to find support from.
Yeah.
That's something that's really surprised me, actually. And just to believe that what you're doing, you know, is the right thing, you know, to just follow your heart and do what feels right for you and really be the best person that you know how to be. And everyone else will, if they don't want to be on board with that, then I think they'll probably be in a minority. I think most people will follow that. You know, they'll see you being happy and they'll feel that energy and they'll want to be part of that.
A perfect way to end. Thank you, Charlie. I've loved this.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
That was the brilliant Charlie Martin. I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. I did too. If you want to get in touch, please do. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. I hope that wherever you are and whatever you're doing, you have a lovely day, and I will speak to you next week. Bye bye.